Hello and welcome to Natasha Explains It All. Today's episode is a bit of a law one-on-one episode that was inspired by some conversations with some friends of mine that made me realize that it's not necessarily widely known what the difference between civil and criminal courts are in state and federal courts, and that a lot of court records are publicly available if you know where to look. And so I thought I would, you know, share this information more broadly. So, and I'm going to be focusing on the United States, so always with that caveat, because legal systems can vary from country to country. So, civil versus criminal courts, what's the difference? The United States has two basic type of courts, civil courts and criminal courts. There are other categories of courts as well, like military courts. The military has its own internal military system of justice, but even then, that tends to be divided into civil and criminal categories. So for the sake of this episode, I'm going to be talking about civil and criminal courts writ large in the United States. And the main difference between these two types of courts is, there's many differences, but one of them being what kind of outcome can come from the case? What can the judge do? What is the remedy? And remedy is a legal term meaning what is the relief, which is another legal term meaning like what's the outcome? What can the judge do to address whatever harm is found to have happened? And in criminal cases, what is generally at stake is the person's physical freedom, either in the form of incarceration, house arrest, electronic monitoring, so they have an ankle monitor, curfews, drug and alcohol testing, whether they're going to be on some type of criminal offender registry, all different forms of impositions on the person's physical freedom, forms of the government taking away someone's physical freedom. In civil cases, generally what's at issue is money. Who's going to have to pay who, how much money? So civil courts, generally it's about money, generally speaking. Criminal courts, generally about person's freedom. And the parties in the cases are different. In civil cases, you have plaintiffs who bring the cases and defendants who defend the cases. In criminal cases, you have a prosecutor and a defendant, and the prosecutor brings the case, the defendant defends against the case. Now, what's the reason for this difference? Criminal cases, as I mentioned, are about the government taking away your freedom. And so the prosecutor in criminal cases is generally, by and large, a government attorney. That person is a representative of the government bringing charges that of violations of criminal law against the person. And I said generally speaking because, and I recommend folks look up this case. There is a recent, incredibly corrupt and unethical exception to this recently, which is about a prosecution of a civil rights and human rights attorney from the United States who is being prosecuted by a private firm rather than a public prosecutor. And just to get into that very, very briefly, because it is a tangent, but a very notable tangent. There is an American attorney named Stephen Dozinger, and I may be mispronouncing his last name, but Stephen Dozinger brought a landmark case against Chevron for massive environmental disaster in South America, and particularly in land inhabited by indigenous people in the Amazon rainforest. Chevron did massive environmental disasters there, including oil spills, and he was able to successfully sue Chevron for that in Ecuador with Ecuadorian courts, and he won a multi-billion dollar judgment against Chevron for its environmental disasters and requiring Chevron to clean up its mess and to compensate the people that it had, whose land they had destroyed, caused cancer to people in the area, and lots of other forms of damage. Why this has to do with criminal courts is that Chevron has gone on such a disgusting campaign against this lawyer who dared to stand up against, you know, multi-trillion dollar multinational corporation that is destroying the environment. And he is certainly the first case I've heard of, and it's a very unique case that in the United States, again, he won this judgment in Ecuador, but in the United States, he's being prosecuted, criminal prosecution being brought against him related to his successful case in Ecuador on all of these sham charges that, you know, he was engaged in misconduct. And rather than it being a typical prosecution where you would have a government attorney be the one who is bringing the charges, in this case, the judge in the case appointed a private firm who has previously represented Chevron to prosecute the case. So he's actually being prosecuted by the defendant, basically, right? By a firm that represented the defendant. And the judge has connections to Chevron as well. It's just very, very sketchy. And like the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, didn't want to get involved anyway. And so he, I don't actually know the latest status of his case, but he was on house arrest for years as a result of this, criminal prosecution by a private law firm against this human rights lawyer. Anyway, Stephen Donziger can look up his case. Setting aside that extreme outlier example, but just another example of corporate malfeasance, setting that aside, most prosecutions, by and large, are prosecuted by government attorneys, because they are enforcing criminal statutes, and the idea is that is the purview of governments to enforce. And prosecutors go by different names depending on what law is alleged to have been broken. You have city attorneys who tend to represent cities, as the name implies. You have district attorneys or DAs, which tend to represent at the county level. You have AGs or attorneys general, or the attorney general, who is at the state level. And then you also have AUSAs, who are assistant U.S. attorneys who are federal prosecutors. And then you have the attorney general of the whole United States, who in this moment is Merrick Garland. But there you have these various levels of prosecutors, and they will prosecute the laws that are within their, what is called, jurisdiction, within their domain to prosecute. So if you hear terms like DA or AG, what they are referring to is like they are the law enforcement official. They are the prosecutor for whatever their level of government is. And on the civil side, you don't have prosecutors, you have plaintiffs who bring cases against defendants. And unlike in the criminal court context, where again, the prosecutor is by and large a government lawyer, on the civil side, the plaintiff can be anybody. The plaintiff can be you, it can be an individual citizen, it can be a group of citizens, it can be an organization, it can be a corporation, it can be a nonprofit, it can be an association, it can be a student, it can be all kinds of people who are plaintiffs. And then the defendant can also be anybody. It could be an individual. It could be a group. It could be a government official. It could be an organization. It could be a corporation. So the main difference there, in a civil case, you have a plaintiff who brings the case. In a criminal case, you have a prosecutor who's brought the case. And civil law is basically anything that's not criminal, which doesn't sound very specific, but let's give some examples. Sorry, there's like a car alarm going off outside, so hopefully the audio recording is not picking that up too badly. There's various types of civil law cases. And so some categories that people may be more familiar with, family law. Family law is all civil. So if you're going to court to get married, to get divorced, for child custody things, for foster care, for child welfare stuff, family law stuff, that is civil. Small claims court is civil. What is small claims court? Small claims court is when, if the dollar amount varies from location to location, but generally speaking, it's when the value of whatever is at issue is under $10,000. So a common example of what might happen in small claims court is, let's say you hired a contractor to do work on your house, and they either didn't do it right, or they didn't complete the work, or vice versa, you didn't pay for the work, and then they take you to small claims court to get their money. If the the small claims court tends to be based on what the max dollar amount at stake is involved is, and oftentimes it's a $10,000 dollar amount. And so if you've got a dispute, oftentimes it's a contract issue. That can be a very common place for small claims court, but that small claims court is often the venue for that. Another common small claims court issue is wage theft or failure to pay wages, right? So if you were not paid your full paycheck, you could bring a claim in small claims court to get your wages back. Separately, again, not to get too far down a tangent, if you haven't been paid properly, there are often like separate government offices where you can file a wage claim, and they will investigate that before it goes into like the formal court process. But it's just another example of small claims court. Oftentimes it's also about wage issues. Another category of civil cases that people hear a lot about are personal injury cases. You were in a car accident and were injured. You were, God forbid, in a plane, you know, that crashed. On a cruise and you got injured somehow, slip and fall cases. Those are personal injury cases. Those are in civil court. Another category of cases that are often in civil courts are sexual harassment cases. Sexual harassment cases are an interesting category because they may also be prosecuted depending on if it rises to the level of criminal behavior as well. And there are a lot of cases that fall into both categories. So I hope I'm not already introducing confusion. But workplace issues are often what falls into civil courts. Employment law in general is handled in the civil court space. So I brought up the sexual harassment example because I have a personal example. I represented a woman, this was some years ago, who had been sexually harassed on the job, and then when she reported it, was fired. And so I represented her in a matter against the former employer, right, alleging not only the sexual harassment but also retaliation, and those are violations of California's labor code. And fortunately, we were able to resolve that case out of court. We mediated the case for a settlement amount. But if that had gone to court, that would have been a civil case. So employment matters are another bucket that are often in civil courts. And I also mentioned personal injury, and I also mentioned family law. Those are just some of the categories. There's also trusts and estates. So for example, someone passes away and there's some type of dispute with their will, about their property, that is also going to be in civil court. Intellectual property cases are also in civil court. So let's say you have two corporations that are suing each other over claiming, you know, that one has stolen the patent of another, you know, or they're using their trademark or whatever, that is generally going to be a matter that is taken care of in civil court. Lots of civil rights cases are also going to be taken care of in civil court. Whether it's a First Amendment case, you know, in challenging limitations on people's ability to protest or engage in certain types of speech, or you are combating local corruption, government malfeasance, criminal justice policies, like suspending people's driver's licenses over unpaid court debt. You know, when you're doing that in a class action setting, that would also be a civil case, which gets me to yet another category of civil cases, which are class actions. And those are cases where you are alleging that many people have suffered the same type of harm. And so you want to have one case that can resolve the issue for everybody in one shot. So those are just a handful of categories of cases that fall into the civil court bucket in comparison to the criminal court bucket. And I mentioned that there are some overlaps, or not overlaps, but the same facts can lead to cases in both courts. So to give an example, let's say there's a case related to police brutality, excessive use of force, and that resulted in someone's death, for example. There could first be a civil case, a wrongful death case, battery allegations, like various forms of civil claims to establish that the person or the persons that the case is being brought against engaged in whatever the conduct is. And if there's a judgment that's won there and the person is found personally liable and is going to have to pay something, then subsequent to that, then a criminal case may also be filed that could be, you know, some type of homicide or murder charge in the case of a wrongful death. And so it's the same facts, excessive use of force, police brutality, someone died at the hands of a police officer, and those same facts could be handled in both civil court and civil claims in order to get either money for the victim and or some type of what is called injunctive relief, which is basically like getting a change in policy. So for example, changing the policy that allows for the use of chokeholds during arrests or things like that. Or in the criminal case, getting that person incarcerated or on probation or having, you know, some type of other type of restriction on their liberty. So there are definitely facts that may result in multiple types of cases. Another, well, I guess this is a crazy example of a type of case that can go into both buckets, but this is, comes from my personal experience as well. So generally, another big bucket of civil court cases are landlord-tenant cases, housing cases. So if a landlord is alleging that a tenant, you know, hasn't paid their rent, or if the tenant is alleging, you know, that the landlord has failed to make necessary repairs, or there's a nuisance, you know, issue, those types of things go to landlord-tenant court. Landlord-tenant court is a civil court. The types of relief, again, the remedies available from that tend to be money, right? Got to pay the rent, or there's going to be a rate, a rent abatement, meaning like the rent is going to be reduced. And then injunctive relief, like I said, which is like change in policy or behavior. So in the landlord-tenant setting, that could be, you know, the landlord is now required to make certain repairs, or it could also be an eviction. The tenant needs to leave, right? That's not a money resolution. That is an injunctive resolution. That is behavior or policy or procedure that has to change. So generally speaking, landlord-tenant court is a civil matter in the United States. However, in the state of Arkansas, Arkansas is the only state in the United States and possibly the world. I don't know the latter, but this is just so insane. Arkansas is the only state in the country that also allows for criminal prosecutions of failure to pay rent. So if you get behind on your rent, your landlord is allowed to take you to landlord-tenant court in civil court and say, hey, you know, this person is not paying their rent. I want to evict them. In Arkansas, the landlord also has the option to use the criminal court system to get a tenant out for non-payment of rent. And they basically treat it like a trespass. So the law is absolutely insane. Like, even if the landlord is completely lying, the landlord can get a notice from the sheriff. The sheriff will serve on the tenant. And it basically says you have 10 days to move out. And if you don't move out within 10 days, you may be prosecuted for a misdemeanor, a criminal misdemeanor, for failure to vacate, non-payment of rent. So it's basically like you're not allowed to be on the property anymore, you're trespassing, and that's how they view it as a criminal matter. It is absolutely wild because most people, even if they have a legitimate claim, like they actually have been paying the rent or they and their landlord came up with some other agreement, most people will just move out if they can because they don't want to face the prospect of criminal prosecution and having a criminal record simply because they are behind on their rent. And in addition to the fact that it's a criminal charge, there are daily fines associated with every day past the 10-day mark if you stay in your house. And it's up to $25 per day. So you can easily imagine a situation where people are paying more in fines than they were than whatever was actually owed in back rent. And because it's a criminal court, not a civil court, the court doesn't actually have the authority to evict the person. It's truly meant to just scare people into self-evicting because most people don't want to go to criminal court. Anyway, I could talk about that for a long time, but in Arkansas is the only state in the country that allows landlords to use the criminal system to evict people, not just the civil system, because they also have a civil landlord-tenant court. And this law has been around for over 100 years, and the reason it has continued to be the law of the land is because there are so many landlords who are in the state legislature, and they are very transparent that the reason they like this is because it's a cheap way for them to evict people. Because, as I mentioned earlier in this episode, right, criminal cases are prosecuted by prosecutors. Civil cases are prosecuted by plaintiffs, like individuals. And so the like Landlords Association in Arkansas is very transparent that it is about saving them money. Because if they go to landlord-tenant court, they generally will have to pay a lawyer to represent them in the matter. But if they bring a criminal case against their tenant, then you have a taxpayer-funded public prosecutor who will bring the case against their tenant. It's so messed up. So going back to that point that prosecutors, government attorneys bring and prosecute criminal cases, in the civil context, it's you, you know, and then whatever lawyer you hire, if you are able to have a lawyer. And so in Arkansas, the business interests of wanting to save money on not having to hire a lawyer to bring a traditional landlord-tenant case in civil court continue to back this criminal law to basically to have taxpayers pay for the prosecution and to basically incentivize people to self-evict. It is insane, but it is illustrative of the differences between civil and criminal courts. So I also wanted to mention that a lot of court records are available to the public, and you can look these up online. It varies a lot, I'm going to warn you, because it depends on how good whatever your local jurisdiction is, how, like, if they even have like an electronic filing system and how well they maintain it. But if you're interested in looking up a case, you can search, you know, search for your court, your county court, or your the state district court, or the federal district court, or the Supreme Court, whatever court. You got to figure out first, like, what is the relevant court of the geographic area you're interested in. And oftentimes online, they will have a search function. You can search by civil or criminal. There may be some additional categories, but generally civil or criminal. And you can generally search either by the person's name or by the case number, which you might not have. So you'll have to search by the person's name. Some of these websites will have paywalls. You will have to pay for production of the records, even if they're just electronic records. And this has been an ongoing problem in the federal court system, because all federal court cases go through an electronic filing system called PACER, and members of the public can use PACER to get copies of federal court filings, but there are fees associated with them. So there's, you know, there's some dialogue about whether that is fair or not. But anyway, the point being that, like, you can generally speaking, you can look up court records. Again, it does vary a lot from place to place. In addition, a lot of places also have public like jail records, so that you can look up who is currently incarcerated in a county jail or in a state or federal prison. Jails are tend to be run by whatever is the local government, so you'll need to look at their website. If you're interested in looking someone up at the state prison level, vinelink.com, vinelink.com is a helpful website for that. If you were interested in looking someone up in the federal prison system, you can look at the BOP inmate locator, BOP inmate locator. BOP stands for Bureau of Prisons. So, so court records are generally available to the public, sometimes with a paywall, and sometimes it can be confusing, as I said, because it depends on what court it is and how well they manage their how well they manage their electronic files. But court records are available to the public, and I encourage you to do some searching, you know, to see how to use the function. It's generally easy to navigate once you know that it exists. I also got a question about what the difference between state and federal courts are. And briefly, they're just different courts depending on what laws that they enforce. So there are laws at every level. There are city level laws, there are county level laws, there are state level laws, and there are federal laws, and there probably are other categories as well. And so the different types of courts just reflect the different types of laws that they enforce. And very generally speaking, the state courts are enforcing state law and the federal courts are enforcing federal law. Again, that is a general statement because state courts also do interpret federal law and federal courts do interpret state law in certain circumstances. But basically, federal cases are about deciding issues of federal law and state cases are about deciding issues of state law. And in the United States, we have a federal system, meaning that if there is a conflict between federal law and state law, federal law trumps, generally speaking. So where there is a conflict, the federal law will prevail over the state law. There's been a lot of gray area on this point, particularly in the last handful of years, but generally speaking, that's the rule. And so, people can be prosecuted in both state courts and federal courts at the same time, as we're seeing right now with Trump, who is being prosecuted both in federal court as well as in state court on different charges. For example, there is a Georgia case related to interference with the 2020 election. And then there's also a case in federal court in Florida related to his retention of classified documents after he was no longer president, and then several other cases. just a little point about state and federal courts are just different based on what laws they are interpreting and upholding. And the term jurisdiction is used a lot because jurisdiction just means like what is within their authority to hear. So I hope that that's a helpful overview of civil versus criminal courts. It's just an overview. This is not comprehensive, but hopefully I've given you a sense of some of the differences in categories between civil and criminal cases, who brings cases, criminal cases versus civil cases, what are the different outcomes that are possible in criminal cases versus civil cases, and then, some differences about state and federal courts, as well as, being able to access court records online. And I will also point out that trials are a thing in both civil cases as well as criminal cases. And there are different rules that apply to them. There are rules of evidence can be different, and part of that can be related to another difference that I did not point out, which is what is the burden of proof in these cases. And the burden of proof means how much does the prosecution, the person bringing the case, have to prove to find the other party, guilty. And so in a criminal case, it is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a phrase I think a lot of people have heard. And in civil cases, it's a lower standard, which is generally something called preponderance of the evidence. And all of these are like fancy lawyer words that honestly vary as to what they mean depending on where you are. But the general understanding is that because, again, the stakes in a criminal case are higher because someone's freedom is on the line, you have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, which is very high level of proof. And in a civil case, it's lower because generally money is what is at stake, which is not trying to minimize that. But our understanding is that the stakes are less than someone's individual freedom in a criminal case. And so in civil cases, again, it varies. Tends to be a preponderance of the evidence standard, which is basically like more than 50%. And beyond a reasonable doubt is much higher than that. So there's a different burden of proof. The plaintiff in a civil case has the burden of proving the plaintiff in a civil case has the burden of proof of a preponderance of the evidence shows, right, that the defendant is guilty of whatever the behavior is, or is liable or is responsible for that. Whereas in the criminal context, the prosecutor needs to demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty of whatever it is. Big caveat there is that the vast majority of criminal cases, and I mean the vast majority, well over 90% of cases at any level of criminal court are resolved by plea bargain. And I talk about that more in my criminal court series that I hope you'll check out, so I won't get into it too much here. But trials in criminal cases, for as much as TV may give you a different impression, trials in criminal cases are extremely rare, because most cases are resolved by plea bargain, because prosecutors just have so much leverage. It's a very nefarious thing, actually, because prosecutors use the plea bargaining mechanism to be able to get, you know, get convictions that they might not otherwise get, but, you know, they can charge whatever. And so a lot of people are willing to plead to something rather than risk going to trial and then potentially being convicted of something far worse and getting much more time. So the idea of a plea bargain is, well, if you plead to this, you're likely to get less time than if you went to trial, which is so problematic for many reasons, but I'll pause there. So point being, trials are a thing in civil cases and criminal cases. They're extremely rare in criminal cases, despite what TV may say. So we talked about the difference in the burden of proof in civil and criminal cases. And I haven't even touched into the whole realm of like administrative law courts, you know, things like, you know, school discipline tends to fall into that category and a whole range of other things. So I won't, because that's a topic for a whole different episode. So with that, I hope that is enough to give you a little bit of footing into what the difference between civil and criminal courts are, getting access to court records online, and a little bit of difference between state and federal courts. And if you have any questions, please send them in. You can find me on Instagram at natasha.t.baker. You can also go to the podcast website and find me there and leave a comment, send in a audio note. I'd love to hear from you. And until next time, take care.